This is Margo Patterson with Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'll be speaking today to Laura Friedman, a former U.S. diplomat, now director of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. But first, a few headlines from the news. Judges at the International Criminal Court ruled last week that the court has jurisdiction over war crimes committed in the Palestinian territories, opening the door to possible criminal charges arising from Israel's assault on Gaza in 2014. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the International Tribunal's decision, quote, pure anti-Semitism, end quote, and rejected its claim of jurisdiction, as did the United States, while human rights groups and Palestinian officials welcomed the news. The International Criminal Court, which is not part of the United Nations, was established in 2002 by dozens of UN member states that signed and ratified the Rome Statute. The statute gives the court a mandate to bring to trial individuals, but not countries or organizations, who are alleged to have committed genocide, crimes against humanity, or war crimes, but have evaded justice because their home countries are unable or unwilling to prosecute them. Israel is reported to be working with allies who are parties to the Rome Statute to pressure the court not to pursue criminal investigations against Israeli officials. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports that some ICC member states have already agreed to warn Israel in advance of any intent to arrest Israelis on arriving in their country or if an arrest warrant is issued against them. An Israeli settler shot dead a Palestinian man from the West Bank town of Ras Karkar last week. Khaled Nofal, a 34-year-old accountant, was killed near an illegal Israeli settlement on the hilltop of Mount Al-Rizan. According to Israeli accounts, Nofal was trying to attack the settler outpost, unarmed, shortly before sunrise. His family deny this. His family say Nofal was executed by settlers when before dawn he headed to his property on Al-Rizan to cultivate it. The mayor of Ras Karkar told the online news site Middle East Eye, quote, Khaled was one of the best young people in Ras Karkar. He was educated, polite, and hardworking. Nothing in the Israeli version makes sense. Why would someone like Khaled attack armed settlers unarmed? And supposing it was true, why did they have to kill him when they could have arrested him? End quote. The outpost on Mount Al-Rizan was illegally established in 2018 on private Palestinian land belonging to inhabitants of Ras Karkar. While all Israeli settlements are illegal under international law, outposts are established without even Israeli government approval. Now to the interview with Laura Friedman. Palestinians have long faced violence at the hands of extremist Jewish settlers in the West Bank. Settlers have vandalized Palestinians' property, burnt their crops, destroyed their olive trees, physically assaulted them. That violence has increased in recent years, and it has escalated still further during the pandemic. Here to talk to us about the upsurge in settler violence, the settler movement, and the explosion in new settlement units in 2020 is Laura Friedman, director of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, a nonprofit established in 1979 to promote a just resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Laura Friedman, welcome to the program.
Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Margo.
Laura, this increase in settler violence during the last several years, and especially during the pandemic, what accounts for it? How is it affecting Palestinians? How is it affecting facts on the ground?
The issue of settler violence isn't new. I think it's important to say that first, because I think that there is a tendency all of us to focus on sort of what our experience is and believe that this is sort of the reality. Settler violence has been a factor in the West Bank since the very earliest days of the settlement movement. And most notably, if you go back into the late 80s and early 90s, there was actually something called the Jewish Underground in the West Bank. And this was a settler movement with support from settler rabbis and important ideological figures that was actually doing things like blowing up West Bank mayors. They had a plan that they were actually going to blow up the Dome of the Rock. And this is well documented. It's just largely forgotten. But there's a direct line between that violence of the 80s and the violence of the 90s, where we saw something like the Hebron Massacre, where a settler, actually an American citizen, went into the Tomb of the Patriarchs, Ibrahim Imas, in Hebron and massacred Palestinians who were actually at prayer in the sanctuary there, largely derailing the peace process. And there's a direct line from that through where we are today. The sort of line that goes through that is a combination of tacit support, tacit approval for violence as a tactic used by Israeli settlers against Palestinians, combined with an active and tacit unwillingness to hold settlers responsible, even responsible to Israeli rule of law. Because the acts of the settlers against Palestinians not only violate Palestinian human rights, violate international law, they violate Israeli law. Someone sent me an article, you know, during the pandemic, where Israel has been very much busy worrying about other things. The settler violence has, you know, increased dramatically. And there was an article in one of the Israeli outlets about how the Israeli security leaders don't quite know how to get a grip on it. And I was joking that this is a hardy perennial in terms of a headline, because every few years we have a headline which says, you know, security forces searching for some kind of strategy to deal with settler violence. And they never find one, because at the end of the day, it really is about political will to engage. And that political will has never existed. And in the Trump era, where you had a U.S. policy that was firmly behind the hardline settlers and their agenda, there was less political will even, or less pressure than there maybe ever been before, combined with an Israeli government, which the settlers, I think, perceived as being very much in their court when it came to taking on the Palestinians. And if you look at the data on the Israeli government actually arresting or sentencing settlers for acts of violence against Palestinians, I think the conclusion is that the settlers are right. They are very much in their court. What we've seen today, certainly in the past year, a surge of violence. And some of that surge, I think, is actually precipitated by the end of the Trump era. The sense by the settlers of, you know, we have to do as much as we can because we're going to get to the point when Trump is gone and we may not have as much room to maneuver. Part of it is about putting pressure on the Israeli political echelons, which they see from Netanyahu and the forces on the right are very much in support and aligned with them. But settlers play an enormously important role in the jockeying for power on the Israeli right. And as we go into new elections, that's more true than ever. And now we're coming into, you know, a Biden era where there is at least a perception, I don't know if it's accurate, that there may be more energy to push back on the settlers' agenda. So you see a doubling down in energy to say, you shall not stop us.
Talk to us about the extremist settlers. The settler violence is committed by a small minority of settlers, most of whom are there for economic reasons. They're provided subsidies and they have an economic motivation to be there rather than an ideological one. Could you say a little bit about the motives of those settlers who are committing violence?
I can talk in general terms. I think, you know, if you've seen one person who commits a crime, you've seen one person. Everybody has their own story. I think that it's important when thinking about the settlers to both, first of all, distinguish the, you know, when people talk about economic settlers, there's this idea that there is a large portion of the Israeli population that has moved to the West Bank, not for ideological reasons, not because they have some messianic drive to resettle the land that was given to the Jews by God as written in the Bible, but because it's advantageous economically. You can get more for your money, there's lots of benefits. And I think that, you know, if you look at a map of the West Bank, you can sort of map out which settlements are more in that category. Those are the ones that more act as sort of suburbs of Israel itself, where it's very easy to go back and forth, and you don't even really know you're living in a settlement. So that's one category. Another category is those who have gone out for ideological reasons, and those tend to be the settlers who live, and by the way, we're talking about second, third, fourth generations here. The settlement movement is old enough now that we have multiple generations, including people who are born there, so it's not enough to say people who went there. But these are people who tend to live in the heartland of the West Bank, and the distinction is important because, you know, for settlers who live in a settlement that's adjacent to the Green Line, which is the dividing line between sovereign Israel and the West Bank, you know, you can imagine a peace agreement down the road where those settlers stay in their homes and there's, you know, some sort of land swap, you know, the lines are changed a little bit and, you know, everyone's happy and the settlers stay. For settlers who have moved into the biblical heartland of the West Bank, where they're living cheek to jowl with Palestinians. The purpose for being there is to say there shall never be a Palestinian state. We shall never give back this land that was given to us by God. And they are largely driven by an ideology which not only views the presence of Israeli Jews in the West Bank as legitimate and right and approved of and desired by God, but views the presence of the Palestinians as entirely illegitimate, you know, non-indigenous, illegitimate, not just not having rights, but being viewed very much as an enemy who's trying to prevent the righteous return of the Jewish people to this land. By and large, I think it's fair to say that most of the violence comes out of that second category. And you can look at this geographically. There are settlements in the West Bank. You know, there's settlements around Hebron. There's settlements in the north, you know, near Nablus, which are just known as centers of violence. You know, the poor Palestinian village who, you know, the Palestinian village that predates 1967, that over the past 25 years has come to have as its neighbors settlers who view the presence of Palestinians on this land as a violation of Jewish rights and Jewish sovereignty. They have a pretty hard time, and you see a lot of violence in those areas. But it's not just in those areas. I would argue, as someone who's been watching settlements and analyzing settler trends for 25 years, that even in the sort of quality of life settlements, if someone moves into the West Bank for quality of life, after a certain amount of time in the West Bank, I think most Israelis become increasingly ideologically identified with the program which says this land must always be Israel's. And there's no way to adopt that worldview without dehumanizing the Palestinians around you. And dehumanization of your neighbors is the pathway to violence. Pathway to violence, whether it's Palestinians attacking Israelis or Israelis attacking Palestinians. It starts with dehumanizing the other.
I think Americans read in the newspaper accounts of settlement growth, but they don't hear a lot about settlers and settler violence. The international community doesn't appear to pay a lot more attention to it. And yet, if you read the bi-monthly UN reports documenting human rights abuses in the Palestinian territories, it's a pretty eye-opening chronicle of what settlers do to make life difficult and dangerous for Palestinians. Why the lack of attention to this issue in our media?
There is no question. I mean, anyone who watches Israel-Palestine as an issue in the media, if an Israeli is injured or killed in violence, it is the source of major headlines in mainstream press and major statements from the US government and other governments. I mean, you hear, I mean, every time. And that's good because, you know, civilians should not be killed. It's a terrible thing. Terrorism is a terrible thing that should be called out. When a Palestinian is a victim of Israeli violence from settlers, or by the way, from the IDF. We're talking here strictly about settler violence, but you know, the fact that the IDF has policies, for instance, of, you know, if they want to show their forces, to show their strength and their control, you know, going into a village and rousting children from their beds. I say that, and I'm sure people are going to say, how dare she? That's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. And I would say, please spend some time on the website of the Israeli human rights organizations. You can argue that their data is also anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, except that it's data. There's videos of the IDF entering homes and rousting children from their beds and lining them up and taking pictures and whatnot. But none of that really does seem to be news in the same way. I think some of that has to do with in-group, out-group dynamics and who people sympathize with or empathize with. Israel and Israelis have long been a population that Americans have been taught to empathize with, and with great reason. There's many reasons to feel a sense of common values and common interests going back from the beginning of the state of Israel. But some of that is built on fiction, and the fact that it is also built on the almost comprehensive dehumanization of Palestinians, starting with statements like a land without a people for a people without a land, as if there were no people on the ground in what was then Palestine before 1948, and that somehow to assert that there were people there is an attack on Israel or an attack on Jews, and to assert that the rights of those people are being violated is just, it becomes almost debatable. It's seen almost as if Israelis are human and have rights, and Palestinians are something to be discussed whether or not they exist, let alone whether or not they have rights that could be violated. I think that's changed somewhat. I mean, I think the situation is better now than it was certainly 20 years ago. But it is really deeply troubling. It's deeply troubling to me. The amount of settler violence we've seen over the past year, it is cresting. It's an ongoing process. It's happening all the time. It's something I've tracked for years, and it's never completely absent from the scene, but it has been cresting. And what we are seeing right now, there has been an absolute burst of settler violence over the past few weeks. People are calling them revenge attacks. But let's be clear what they're revenge for. The settlers are engaging in acts of violence against Palestinians over the past few weeks on a nightly basis almost, to get revenge after an Israeli settler teen died in a car crash when he was being chased by Israeli police, nothing to do with Palestinians. And the Israeli police were chasing the settler teen because he and his friends were accused of throwing rocks at Palestinian cars on a road in the West Bank. So you have Israeli youth attacking Palestinians. The Israeli police, in a relatively rare case, pursued them. There was a car crash and a teenager died. And in revenge for this death of this teenager, and there can be legitimate questions over whether he should have died, whether police acted correctly or incorrectly. That's a legitimate thing to debate and investigate. But the revenge for the death of this teen is for the Israeli teens to turn their wrath on Palestinians. And there's total silence. The United States says nothing. The international community says nothing. And every day this is happening.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Margo Patterson with Understanding Israel-Palestine, and I'm talking to Laura Friedman, Director of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Laura, you mentioned this Israeli youth was killed when the police were chasing him for throwing rocks and how unusual that was. And B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, reported at the end of January that between the 21st of December, when this young man died, to the 24th of January, there were 49 incidents involving violence by settlers that in at least 26 of the cases, Israeli security forces were on hand while these attacks were going on, but did not prevent them. In 5 cases, instead of arresting the assailants, they shot rubber bullets or tear gas the victims. And that goes to this question, are the settlers protected because they have political influence or because they're actually serving the ends of the Israeli state?
It's a great question. Fundamentally, this comes down to occupation. And occupation doesn't exist separate from the Israeli government. Occupation is an artifact of the Israeli government. The occupation is run by something called the civil administration, which is an Orwellian term for an arm of the Israeli Ministry of Defense that operates in the West Bank and runs the West Bank. And Israel, for the purposes of its settlements, increasingly treats large areas of the West Bank as parts of its sovereign territory in terms of applying its laws in an extraterritorial manner and all sorts of things. What we see when it comes to settler violence, and again, I would encourage listeners who are listening to this with some, you know, skepticism, this can't be true what you're saying, to get online. And years ago, it used to be very easy for people to say, well, you can't believe the Palestinians. They make stuff up and advocates of the Palestinians are lying or they've been taken in. The thing is that today everything is videoed. There's video online of pretty much every incident in the West Bank. And it gets very little attention. You know, Israelis who follow maybe Haaretz will see it because Haaretz, the sort of progressive paper in Israel, will sometimes publish video. But the videos over and over show settlers engaging in acts of violence while there are IDF troops nearby or alongside them, not stopping them, failing to stop them in any way, and failing to protect the Palestinians in any way. Part of the problem is that the role of the IDF in the West Bank is very clearly defined, and it is not the role of the IDF to protect Palestinians from settlers. The role of the IDF is to protect settlers, period. There are Israeli police in the West Bank, and they're very small in numbers. They are under-resourced massively, and they are under, I would argue, under-motivated politically to engage. But if a Palestinian is being attacked by settlers, calling the IDF is not going to get them help. What they're going to have to do is call the civil administration. The civil administration is going to have to send out the police. And that's how you end up with the police chasing kids who are throwing rocks. The best the IDF really can do, and what you see over and over in these videos, you will see the IDF basically standing with the settlers, because they're obviously, we are all together on the same side kind of feeling. They're trying to interpose themselves between the settlers and the Palestinians, as if to say, guys, come on, don't go too far. That's what you see in the West Bank. And that really does come down at the end of the day to the political motivations of the Israeli government. Occupation, the term occupation is a term that suggests temporary interim between, you have an occupation until the situation resolved and the occupation ends. And what you see on the ground essentially is the IDF in the service of the settlers and the settlements, which as a political item, a political agenda item for the Israelis are not temporary. And the goal of pushing the Palestinians into smaller and smaller areas of the West Bank or pushing them off the land entirely is entirely consonant with, if not a core part of, the broader agenda that is behind the settlements.
This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm talking to Laura Friedman, Director of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. 2020 saw Israel approving a record number of new settler units on the West Bank. In October, the watchdog organization Americans for Peace Now announced more than 12,000 units had been approved. Thousands more have been approved in the months since the U.S. presidential election. The most controversial approved 5 hours before the Biden administration took office in an area of East Jerusalem called Givat Hamatos. It's the first new Jewish settlement in East Jerusalem in 20 years. Many people regard the development at Givat Hamatos as a death blow to the two-state solution. Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, said that the decision by Israel to build in Givat Hamatos is an attempt by Israel to, quote, kill the internationally supported two-state solution, end quote. Laura, what's your assessment of the importance of this particular settlement? Do you agree with those who say it would be devastating if it goes forward, or is it already too late to put any credence in a two-state solution anyway?
It's a great question. You know, starting where you ended, I am someone who, you know, for years has talked about the dangers to the two-state solution. And, you know, Givat Hamatos is one of the settlements we point to as the possible, you know, death blow, you know, nail in the coffin. It feels a little bit disconnected from reality to be using that framing right now, because, you know, the two-state solution is not on the table. The only people who actively support the two-state solution these days is the Palestinian Authority. And, you know, that's, they have no power and there are no negotiations. And on the ground, the Israeli government has spent the past 4 years, certainly under Trump, doing everything possible to make sure that there is no turning back, you know, cross the point of no return. And when you talk about the rush or the burst of settlement approvals and construction in the past 4 years, that's what that was about, right? That was about an Israeli government very much in sync with the US government, taking advantage of the opportunity. They said this explicitly numerous times, you know, we've got to do this while we have Trump in power. You know, the most pro-Israel administration in history, what they really meant is pro-greater Israel administration in history. And you saw that really rev up towards the end of the Trump administration when you sort of got the feeling that Netanyahu and others were saying, okay, this is going to be our last chance to approve some of this stuff because once the new administration comes in, it's going to be harder. So quick, get to it. Now, Givat Hamatos is a deeply problematic settlement. It's the efforts, the plans to build Givat Hamatos have been on the books for years. And it is deeply problematic. And I think it's worth sort of, you know, articulating a little bit more. When we talk about Givat Hamatos preventing a two-state solution, that starts from the idea that if there's going to be a two-state solution, it's going to have to require a solution in Jerusalem, which allows for a Palestinian capital in Jerusalem that is separate from the Israeli capital. And that will only work, and this is just a basic understanding of anyone who's worked on Jerusalem as an issue, you know, there's got to be an Israeli capital where Israelis can move around without crossing, you know, Palestinian checkpoints, and Palestinians can move around without crossing Israeli checkpoints. So you can be side by side. That's not possible with Givat Hamatos. Givat Hamatos actually will encircle a neighborhood called Beit Safafa, which is, it crosses, it's a Palestinian neighborhood of East Jerusalem, but it crosses the Green Line. And in the southern part of Jerusalem, it will cut off the possibility of any contiguity between the West Bank and Jerusalem on that southern flank. It basically will complete the encirclement of southern Jerusalem. You have Gilo and you have Har Homa, these two other big settlements. And once you put this final piece in, you've created sort of this wall of settlements. So there can never be a connection between a Palestinian state and its capital in Jerusalem from the south. There's another settlement plan called E1, which is sort of in the northeast, which would do the same thing there. There's another one in Atarot, which they're just talking about now, which would do the same thing in the north. And the political motivation behind Givat Hamatos is to do exactly that. You know, often when we talk about Israel-Palestine, someone like me will give an analysis and say, ah, but you know, you're attributing intent. This is part of the anti-Semitic, anti-Israel conspiracy theory, right? From you lefty Jews, you're attributing intent. I don't have to attribute intent when I'm discussing what the purpose of Givat Hamatzos is there for. The people who support Givat Hamatzos will articulate the intent, and the intent is to prevent any future division of Jerusalem, full stop. And it's been approved. Now, you know, what's going to happen now? I mean, this goes back again to, you know, is it possible to even talk about, you know, death blows to two-state solution? The final approval for Givat Hamatzos happened just before inauguration, and the tenders were awarded on inauguration day. And tenders being awarded is sort of a point of no return, because at that point you have, you know, private sector, third-party equities that are now involved. It's not just a political decision, and reversing those or canceling them is a much heavier political lift for any government. It's highly unlikely to go back. And the response of the Biden administration, I think probably it's not unreasonable to say on day one they didn't want to fight with Israel on inauguration day, but you know, we're now in February and they haven't said anything about Givat Hamatzos, and Givat Hamatzos is moving forward. The challenge, I think, for those of us who want to feel hopeful for prospects for a peace agreement, for negotiations, for a two-state solution at some point, is that the modus operandi of the US government since pretty much the start of the peace process up through the Trump era, the MO was, all right, we oppose these things. If they build settlements, we'll say they're bad, you know, we'll object, but we won't do anything to stop them. We're never going to invest the political capital to actually impose a cost on Israel for doing these things. And then after the fact, once Israel's done them, we will somehow adjust the entire concept of a two-state solution, the whole peace process paradigm, to accommodate them after the fact. So, you know, for folks who are saying, well, Givat Hamatzos is going to be a death blow to the two-state solution, I'm pretty sure there's probably people right now in the State Department who are figuring out a way to reimagine the two-state solution, which somehow the Palestinians manage without having an attachment to Jerusalem from the south. And they manage with Beit Safafa being encircled by settlements. I mean, that's how it's gone for the past 25 years. You know, there's this idea somehow, if you are a policymaker in the US motivated either by a preference for Israel being greater and bigger, or you're motivated by a desire to not see the US have to fight with Israel, there is an idea that the two-state solution is infinitely malleable and can be stretched and tweaked to accommodate literally anything Israel does on the ground. And frankly, that's not unlike what President Trump suggested, where he basically said, you know, let's stop objecting to Israeli settlement construction that we know they're going to do anyway. Let's figure out what Israel wants to do. Let's put a map giving them a green light to do it. And then let's explain why whatever's left will be fine for a state. And I worry that things like the incredibly subdued US response, there'll be no response to Givat Hamatzos, potentially signals that, you know, we're not going to call it the Trump plan, and we're not going to use terms like Bantustans, and we're going to be mad if people do, but we're going to end up with a policy which basically says, all right, everybody, we just have to deal with reality. And the reality is Givat Hamatzos is going to be built.
I've been speaking to Laura Friedman, director of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Laura Friedman, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.